Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live the good life and create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social conscious and unconscious dynamics and desires. Edgy Ideas is proudly sponsored by the Eco Leadership Institute. We offer coach and leadership training courses, and we have a vibrant community of practice where international members join once a month for a webinar. Our focus is on co-creating the good society. To find out more, go to www.ecoleadershipinstitute.org, and to read my polemic blogs and essays, go to Simon Western at Substack. Thank you for listening. Welcome to this edition of Edgy Ideas podcast. Today, my very special guest is the Reverend Richard Carter. Richard is the Associate Vicar for Mission. He was ordained in 1992 and is currently full-time vicar at St. Martin in the Fields Church, which is in Trafalgar Square, London. Richard has a special responsibility for education, international affairs, and has links with the St. Martin's Homeless, which is called the Connection Provision for the Homeless. Previously, Richard spent 15 years in the Solomon Islands as chaplain to Melanesian Brotherhood monks in the Solomon Islands. Richard is a founder and leader of the Nazareth Community, which brings monastic living into the busy secular world. He's also author of three books. The latest book is called The Letters from Nazareth. Richard, very nice to have you on our program. How are you?
It's good to see you, Simon. Always good to see you.
Good. So Richard and I met, I think it's 11 years ago, when I suffered a trauma. I was in London, and my son was killed through knife crime, and I was in quite a state. And I was introduced to Richard, and Richard was incredibly supportive to me, which I'm forever grateful for, Richard. It was a very important relationship, and you two related to my trauma because you had experienced trauma in your life, hadn't you?
That's right. I'd been through a time in the Solomon Islands before I came back here, where seven members of my community had been killed while working for peace. And I'd been the chaplain of the community during that time. So it was a time of great grief and pain, but also of trying to find all that was good even after the grief, as it were, or through the grief.
Yeah, yeah. And that's a journey I've been on of how you live with grief and live with hope. And my experience is that if you try and repress the grief too much, then your living with hope doesn't work so well. So you have to kind of work with the two in a healthy way. And it's been a very painful but also beautiful journey in many ways.
It's strange, isn't it? Because people always see only the destructive side of grief, but also grief is I think something which transforms your life in many ways, in a kind of a positive way as well. In that it makes you realize where you stand, and it makes you realize the things which should be your priorities and the things that you believe in, and the person you're grieving for. Somehow you feel you've got to live not only your life, but you've got to live with their energy as well, or you've got to have learned something from them and all that they would want from you, as it were.
Yeah, that was very strong for me, the feeling that, you know, at times I was in deep despair, especially in the early days, and you felt like giving up, but it's like I had a responsibility. You know, Finn wouldn't want this. Finn would really want me to live a full life and a good life, and here we are today.
I remember meeting you and you being able to talk about it. I mean, some people find it very, very difficult, obviously, to talk about their grief, but you were able to speak about it in a really heartfelt way, which I thought was incredibly courageous. And we hold here a service at St. Martin's each year for the victims of homicide. I mean, to remember the victims of homicide, it's especially for their families and friends. And the service has become a really important service where people gather and they receive peer support from one another, because it's something that they've all been through. And Simon, I asked him if he would speak, and he spoke very, very powerfully one year and helped a lot of people through what he shared. It's a journey, you know, it's a journey through grief, really. And I had the service this last Saturday, and I was speaking at that one, and I was saying that you know, grief lasts all of your life, and yet all of your life it is calling you to live in the way that you believe is important and the person who has died would want you to live. And I looked around the congregation at the people who were there, and I realized that so many of them have actually found help and healing by being great people, by being people who've helped others who've been going through similar situations. This organization is called Support After Murder and Manslaughter, but they're a wonderful community who really support one another.
Yeah, I remember speaking at that event and was deeply, deeply moved by a church full of people who experienced what I'd experienced. And then people talking to me afterwards, like, as you say, being very, very grateful. And even before this podcast, I talked to my wife, Agata, and I said, I don't know whether I should mention this or not. There's almost like some shame about talking about a child who's been murdered. People aren't comfortable with it, and thought, no, it needs to be spoken of. It needs to be kind of just shared. And you gave me that opportunity, and I met those people, and there's a real feeling of solidarity and love there.
I agree completely about it needs to be spoken about, and otherwise it just remains like the kind of the iceberg beneath the sea that you never see, and yet every day of your life it forms you and forms who you are. And the seven members of my community, there's never a day that goes past when I don't at some stage think of them. One of them was called Francis, who was very close to me, and I've told the story at the service on Saturday, where shortly before he died, I mean, I knew his life was in danger because he was very courageous. He was working for peace in this ethnic conflict. And I'd heard that he was being targeted, and I told him to be really, really careful. And he just said to me, look, he said, I would be frightened if I was doing something wrong, but I'm not frightened doing what's right. And he wrote on my book the word courage. And that was 20 years ago. But every time, you know, when you wake up in the morning, you've got those huge stressful days, or you're struggling with something, or you've got something that's gone wrong. Every time, it's almost like he's still whispering that word, courage, courage, courage. You know? So it's been a great, I don't think we can let the dead die and just be no more. They've got to continue to inspire us. And I know that's very true of your son.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, he still brings me joy and you know, great sadness, of course. And I go through, you know, anniversaries and stuff are very tough, and things which trigger kind of memories. But immense joy still, and actually to my children, we, you know, I speak of Finn, and when the sun shines through the clouds, they say, "There's Finn saying hello." And it's actually, yeah, he had a great spirit, and that spirit's still within me and lives with us.
Well, there is an intensity when someone dies young. There is an intensity in that you just hold with you always, and people, you know, like sort of look a bit concerned and worried about that. But actually, I found it a very positive thing. I found it a sense of inspiration, really, and I found writing very helpful. You mentioned that I've written three books, but when I came back from the Solomon Islands, it was about a year and a half after their deaths, But I came back here to here, and I had 3 months before my new job started, and I went to the Holy Island in Northumberland, and I wrote a book about those seven brothers called In Search of the Lost, because I wanted their story to be remembered. And I remember I wrote in the mornings and sort of walked around the island in the afternoons. It was very sort of windswept island. I felt like I was kind of, my grief was being scoured away, you know. And writing was a really cathartic process. It was like, it's like when you can write or remember them and actually put it down on paper. I found it really, really helpful.
Yeah, maybe one day I'll do that. I it's interesting. I, up to now, it's been too raw, but I did actually write a book during that grieving process after the first year when I was feeling a bit better. And yeah, there's a deep kind of sense of almost like meditation on as I wrote it. It was a book on coaching and about human relationships.
Yeah.
It wasn't explicitly about Finn, but it was a very interesting and very important kind of act for me of kind of working through the grief.
Yeah. No, I agree. I agree.
You've moved it into you moved from the Solomon Islands to St. Martin's in the Church, which is one of my favorite churches. I was a regular when I lived in the East End of London.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful church. It's last time I was there was a few 2 weeks ago with my children. We visited London, and just the sermons and the social justice kind of side of the church, to work with the homeless, is very important. Do you want to share some of the things you're doing at the church, Richard?
Yeah, it couldn't have been more different from the Solomons, if you could imagine. I've told you this before, but I tell for the listeners. I came back from the Solomon Islands, wrote that book on Holy Island, then came and got this job to work at St. Martin the Fields. That was 17 years ago, and I'm still working here today. And the one thing you can say about this church is it's never boring. I mean, every day is different. And when I first moved in, I live next door to the church, in the house next door to the church. When I first moved in, you know, like, I'd moved from an island where there was no electricity and there was only one road on the whole island, and everybody sort of moved about by foot. And I moved into Trafalgar Square, and I thought I was never, ever going to sleep again. You know, like, when all the people are gone home by about 2 o'clock in the morning, then they start emptying the bottle banks, and there are sirens and ambulances, and it's just so noisy. And I thought, what the hell have I been brought here for? Then I began to see, really, that just my life in the Solomons had taught me about community, about the importance of just sharing simply, humbly with people, you know, the importance of food, the importance of presence, the importance of visiting, the importance of being there for people when they were in need. And I began to see that my ministry here was very, very similar. And although the two situations couldn't be so far removed or different, in fact, the same, it was basically the same need, the need for community, the need for some kind of stability in the middle of the city. And I felt the need for meditation and the need for prayer and something that kept the rhythm of that life open to people who are walking past. Now, St. Martin's has always been called the church with the ever-open door, because we had a vicar here in 1919 called Dick Shepherd, who came home traumatized by the First World War. I mean, he was absolutely horrified by the violence in France. And he came to St. Martin's to become the vicar here. And he became a lifelong pacifist after witnessing the horror of the First World War, but came into this church in one of his early sermons, preached the words that this should be a church with an ever-open door, where people of all walks of life should be able to sit down side by side, and there should be no discrimination, but they would all know that this is the place where they could experience the love of God. And he opened up the church to First World War soldiers coming back from the front line, arriving at Charing Cross. And it was, in those days, the church was open day and night. And it became known for its hospitality and its sense of welcome. And from there, it went on to become known for its work with homeless people. And when I first came here, I just thought, who's my new community going to be? Because I'd been the chaplain of this Melanesian Brotherhood and a brother myself. I thought, who's going to be my new community? And then I suddenly realized that there were lots of people who used to come in to keep warm and sit around the edges of the church. And I thought, yeah, these are going to be my community, these people who from all different parts of the world who have come into the church to seek warmth, to seek sanctuary, to seek safety.
Yeah.
So that's how my ministry began here. And from feeling like a fish out of water, I suddenly began to realize that, wow, what an opportunity to be part of a church where you don't have to go out and look for people, but where people with such gifts, but also such stories and such hardships and struggles, you know, actually come into the church seeking comfort or seeking hope or seeking God. So it's been a brilliant place to work. And about 10 years ago, I founded what we call the International Group, which began to realize that many of the people who came into the church here were people who couldn't really apply for traditional homelessness organizations because they didn't have the rights. In other words, they were people with no recourse to public funds, so you couldn't get them immediately into housing or you couldn't get them into work. And so they were kind of being left behind. And 10 years ago, we started the International Group, which was an attempt to provide community for people who are refugees or asylum seekers or with no recourse in London. And for me, that's been a wonderful, wonderful experience as well. Because again, I think our last count, there were people from 45 different countries of the world have become part at different times of our community.
Yeah, that's beautiful work, beautiful work.
Yeah.
How do you with your work? I know it's very demanding and you have so many different roles. You're preaching thoughtful sermons and you're working with the homeless and you've set up this Nazareth community, which we'll talk about in a bit. How do you sustain yourself? What sustains you through this work?
Well, I'm a person who goes through ups and downs myself. I mean, it's not all sort of plain sailing, as it were. But I found I grew up in a religious house. My father was a vicar, so I kind of learnt the kind of generosity of the Christian faith when I was young. And my dad was very kind of open and an inclusive kind of person. But from the Melanesian Brotherhood, what I learnt was the importance of a real rhythm of prayer, which is very, in many ways, very much like the Muslims. You know, they prayed five times a day, and that kind of rhythm and structure of prayer provided a kind of a breakwater, as it were, so that every part of the day you were reminded of what was at your very center, your core of your being. Early in the morning, we used to gather about 6 o'clock in the morning for our first prayer and have the first hour of total silence. And as the sun broke, and then later in the day, in the lunchtime, early evening, and the night before you went to sleep. And that rhythm is something actually very beautiful. It gives a kind of shape to the day. And so when I came to St. Martin's, I began to feel like a battery that was running out. And more and more, I love the work here. I, you know, love the people. I loved all the experiences of it. But you could end up feeling a bit like an events manager, where you're just sort of producing lots and lots of different kind of events that are taking place in the church, and feel almost like your center was being sucked out of you. You know. So. This is the Nazareth community. I began to think maybe I'm called to something different, you know, to leave the city behind and go and become a monk again in some kind of quiet religious settlement. And actually I did. I took a month out and I went and lived in a kind of Franciscan monastery for a month. And as I was there, I kept on hearing that in my thoughts or in my heart, the thinking, yeah, this is beautiful. This is really, really nice. But the city is your monastery.
Mm-hmm.
That's the place where you're needed, you know. And I also love multicultural living. I mean, I've worked all my life with people from different parts of the world. And, you know, I think it's such an exciting thing to do, to work with people from experiences from all parts of the world who have enriched our culture here. So after my month, I came back and the vicar here, Sam Wells, asked me, "So what have you decided?" And I've said to him, "The city is my monastery." And he laughed and said, "Well, what are you going to do about it?" So I said, "Well, I think this is going to have to be my community here." And so we opened up this community with a rhythm of prayer and a structure of contemplative prayer, because I think we've got far too many words in our modern liturgies. You know, like we're always talking
yes
about God and to God, but we don't really spend much time listening to ourselves, listening to the world, listening to the voice of God, or the voice of a conscience bigger than our own. And so I set up this rhythm of life that was based on seven S's. Silence was going to be the first one of them. And rather than just sort of start a committee meeting and start planning an agenda, I just thought, for the first year, I'm just going to keep silence. So an hour every morning, I kept silence. And on a Wednesday morning, I went out into the park, in St. James's Park, and kept an hour of silence in the park every Wednesday and just watched the season change. And I began to find that this hour of silence in the day was like rooting me again in the kind of spirit that I was in danger of losing. It was actually awakening me to the wonder of stuff all around me, that it's so easy to get blocked out when you get sort of full up with clutter and your mind gets full up with distractions and anxieties and worries. So that kind of rhythm of an hour of silence a day really kind of held me. And there was a group who started joining me, and one of them in particular, who even did the hour in the park, come rain, come shine. And after the first year, we decided that, you know, we wanted to open this up for others. And the seven S's were silence, service, but real service, not kind of service on a computer and sort of arranging agendas and meetings, but service where you met someone face to face and you offered what you could offer them, and they offered perhaps to you even more in return. So face to face service. And then the third one was sacrament. Now, sacrament obviously has very religious connotations in the Christian church about bread and wine. But for us, sacrament was the idea that the word is made flesh, our flesh, and that holiness is part of the world, and that you can find holiness and goodness and God in one another, and often in people who may not even think themselves to be Christian or Buddhist or Hindu or Muslim. You can find God in all things, and I think that the world is a sacramental world. Sacrament means the outward visible sign of an inward invisible grace. And I think when you become more attentive to the world, you start beginning to see those blessings in one another. So that was the third S, sacrament, trying to become sacrament and trying to see the blessing of God in people you met and in the world in which we live. And then the fifth S was scripture, to go back to our scriptures and to try and see them as part of your own life. And then the fifth S was sharing, generosity. Because in Melanesia and the church, which is going to thrive, or any community that's going to thrive, I think there's got to be a real generous spirit. And so that this ability to share generously and listen. And then the sixth S was Sabbath time, the idea that we need time to replenish tired spirits, doing things we love, like walking or gardening or listening to music, or me going to the theatre, or I love going to the art galleries, or just simply walking around London. I love the parks here, just love them.
Yeah.
But that was Sabbath time. And the final one was staying with, so trying to find a stability. So your listeners may think, wow, why has this man stayed for 17 years in one place? But I began to see that lots of priests move on after 4 or 5 years, but actually here in the centre of London, where life is so fractured and people are so, you know, everyone's moving on all the time, that what I felt called to was just being still in the middle of a very, very eclectic, busy city. Anyway, that's the idea. Maybe others would have a different idea, but I like that idea of stability in the middle of a changing city. So those seven S's, and that's what we've tried to live.
Very, very interesting. I found a real attachment to monasteries as well, and monastic living. I was, before Finn died, maybe 15 years ago, I went to my first Benedictine or Camaldolese monastery in the US.
Yeah.
And I kind of thought, all these words like obedience and stability, like that's not Simon. Simon's kind of this action, you know, I'm someone who can't sit still for much. And although I was a Quaker, and the hour of silence and getting Quakerism once a week was like very important to me, as I became a Quaker in midlife, and then kind of started to really understand my own spirituality in a deeper way. But in a monastery, this rhythm of prayer, I mean, I was totally, totally besotted. It was like, this is, I felt so at peace. Like, I mean, I think it took me kind of a 24 hours to stop fidgeting and kind of like, you know, start getting into the rhythm. But after a week, it's like, I just didn't want to leave. It was like, I'd found something very, very special. And the silence was just so important. And you realize just like in the secular world, how little silence you get. And then the vow of stability. I mean, these vows of obedience, of stability, they're absolutely countercultural. They're radical. Like, you know, they really challenge kind of all the things we talk about, you know. And like you say, to be still when everyone's kind of on the move. These things are very important, aren't they? And this monastic feeling is really strong with you, isn't it? It's kind of like really informs something.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And I agree with you totally about, you know, we kind of think of obedience as something that is countercultural and something, oh, I don't want to be obedient. But actually, obedience is obviously based on the word of a deeper listening. And the structure of that rhythm of prayer, you know, look at the Muslims who go to pray 5 times a day, shoulder to shoulder, that kind of wave of prayer. It holds them. I remember going into a mosque in Jakarta, which was bigger than you could ever imagine, and seeing thousands of people praying together. And I went out onto the streets, and there was great poverty at that time. And I thought, you know, here this rhythm of prayer is holding them through the kind of the turbulent lives that people are living and their struggle against poverty. And I think here, you know, I'm always saying about St. Martin's, it's got to have that heartbeat of prayer. It's got to have that rhythm at the very center. And that's not just for Christians, that's for anyone entering. You can feel it. You can feel it if this place is a place of peace and a place of welcome. And one of my prayers every morning is, we pray that this space is a place where the love of God is found. You know, anyone walking in here will find a kind of a centeredness.
Yeah. And also, you know, I pick up on that idea of sacramental. The you know, when I'm in London and when I lived down the East End, I used to go to the East London Mosque quite a lot. And it was not usually during prayer time, but just sitting on the carpets, watching people pray, having my own prayer. And just like in the busy city, to have that kind of silence again, that space. And I pop into the Krishna temple whenever I'm in London as well. It's kind of I wear the Krishna beads. It's kind of been part of my life as well, you know. I go to the festivals and the rock festivals, and everyone else would be kind of listening to the bands, and I'd be sat with the Krishnas talking to them, you know, exploring spirituality, and just something very, very beautiful around. And again, nature, the parks, you know, I live in Galway by the sea, and just spending time, you know, listening to the sea and listening to kind of my own kind of spirit life is so important.
And that really happened, you know, in 1990. I mean, this new book that I've written that you've mentioned called Letters from Nazareth, A Contemplative Journey Home, it is really, I wrote a letter every month to my community, but it was really like the whole of the city of London suddenly became like a monastery. You know, I'd written about the city as my monastery, and then suddenly it was like that. You looked out here on Trafalgar Square and there was absolutely no cars, no people. And I think alongside all the pain and the struggle and the suffering, and there was a lot of suffering here because a lot of the people got left behind, you know, especially homeless people and especially refugee and asylum seeker community. So there was a lot of struggle and there's no negating that. But there was also a sense that the world stopped and began to listen again. And that those mornings of going out walking and seeing the trees that, you know, will outlast us and live far longer than us, and seeing the way they're so rooted and they follow the rhythm of the year and the way they burst into bud and leaf and then, you know, and then become a kind of canopy of leaves and then fall and the whole of the park golden, you kind of become much more attentive to the things around you and the things that are greater than you. And I think for many people, they had a taste of that, you know, the song of the birds, the way birds were singing in a way that we hadn't listened to before for so many years, or perhaps it was because the traffic stopped that they were listening. And that sense of our own mortality, which we kind of block out most of the time, we're so busy with our lives that we've forgotten that we're mortal, which is a great mistake. The Buddhists always say that we must, you know, continually be aware of our deaths, you know, like it's not something to block out. St. Francis of Assisi says, blessed are those who are found doing God's holy will, for death will do them no harm. It's almost like, you know, you can befriend life and death if you become attentive to the world in which you live. But if you block it out, these things become alien and a stranger to you.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. When I was a young child, I learned about death early. I was 5 years old and my seven-year-old brother died of leukemia. And it was he just disappeared from my life. And he was my favorite brother. He looked after me. He was a beautiful kind of a brother. And I remember when I was first went into therapy in my early 20s, I was trying to make some sense of this. And often people kind of talk about kind of the grief and how you overcome it. And I was saying, yeah, there's that. But there's also like, I've got this life force. It's like I'm living for Stephen as well. And it's like giving me something. And I'm very aware of mortality. And I remember saying this to the therapist, saying it's not all kind of one story of grief and hurt and reparation. That's part of it for sure. But how do you kind of live with that? And I found myself working in Alderhay Children's Hospital, kind of doing like putting that energy into kind of you know, helping six children and stuff. And it's very interesting process and that mortality, that realization that, you know, there's it's close, you know, we never know, and life is so precious, you know, and make the most of it.
And do you still feel his presence now?
I do. I have his I have his picture on my bedside table, and there he is, Stephen. Yeah, beautiful.
But that's a lot of grief for you to go through, a loss of a close brother and then a loss of a son.
It's a lot, and it gets more. I mean, a year after Finn died, my mother died of cancer, and then 2 years later my father died, and then 3 years after that my older brother died suddenly of cancer again. And it's like, yeah, it's been a life of grief, but at the same time I've had two young children and set up a new life in with a love beautiful family in Galway, and it's I live in a very strange world, Richard, between these positions.
Yeah, I've seen the kids, they're really beautiful.
Yeah, they're absolutely beautiful, and it's a big question about how we live with life, you know, life and death, how we live in that space, I think.
But there seems a temptation in our world at the moment to want to always, when something bad happens, to find the cause or the blame or to point the finger. And somehow it means that people actually never come to terms with the fact that we are mortal, you know, that you won't go on living forever, as it were.
Yeah. And when I was a young man, before I'd really processed this stuff, I remember I'd be a big party kind of guy, and we'd loads of friends and lots of kind of action, and but then I'd go off to a desert, and I'd tell people, you have to get in touch with your melancholy. Unless you get in touch with your melancholy, like, you know, you're not understanding yourself. And I didn't understand what I was saying, really, but now looking back on it, I'm still doing it. You know, I'm off to a monastery tomorrow, and it's like pre-Christmas, you know, 4 days of just being with Finn, being with Stephen, being with my family, being with myself, and being with God, you know, in that kind of deep, kind of quiet space.
I'm exactly the same, because I've got friends on New Year. They've invited me. I mean, after New Year, they wanted me to go down and be with them. And I just said to them, look, I need, after Christmas and New Year at St. Martin in the Fields in Trafalgar Square, I just need to be by myself. And they thought I was being really unfriendly, but I was trying to explain to them, it's not unfriendly. It's just I need space. And I go to this little bothy in Scotland, where I've got this beautiful friends who lend me this bothy, and looking out through silver birch trees across the mountains. And I just spend a week sort of writing and walking and just cooking and listening to it's got a kind of real fire in there that you sort of stoke up with cut timber, and, you know, boil coffee on the top of the hob and stuff. And it's just so healing to be in that space of quiet. I mean, I'm not one of these people who would like to be like that all my life. I don't think I'd like silence forever. But those times of silence are just beautiful.
They are. And although I think for a lot of people who haven't experienced that, I think there's kind of an anxiety and fear. And when you first stop, when you've been really, really busy, you can get flooded with a lot of emotions and thoughts. And I think that happened in COVID for many people when they got locked down. I think, you know, I've written an essay about I called it In Praise of the Thermos Flask, and it was about when I was locked down, I'd go and meet friends up on the hill, and I sat on my own and just recovering that kind of space, and just how beautiful it was, like, to be with nature, to be where I was. I used to go cycle into town and go to the busy cafes. I'd then go to nature, just that the kind of beauty. But I do think that there's people who kind of experience that, you have to kind of realize there's going to be a rising up of emotions, whatever's going on for you, you know, and then you get this deep kind of sense of peace following that, I think.
Yeah, and somehow to you know, the teaching that the thoughts or the distractions that fill your head and seem so overwhelming, like dark clouds that come into your head, they're not you. They're clouds that come and they fill you and they churn up your psyche, but they do pass.
Yeah.
I think I always love that line, you know, remember, the cloud comes, the cloud fills your mind, and the cloud goes, but you are not the cloud, you are part of the sky. And that sense that we have got this spaciousness within us, that if we just, we stick with it, and you know, all of us have got stuff that troubles us and bothers us, and grief that sometimes completely overwhelms us and makes us feel rubbish. And we've all got that voice on our, you know, in our head, that it's our fault, or that it's the stuff we've done wrong, or that we're not capable, or that we're losers, or whatever your negative spirit is, tells you. But there is something much, much greater than that negative voice. There is a voice of life. There is a voice that we've talked about, of Finn, your son, or my seven brothers, courage. That voice which calls us to live a life greater than ourselves, and through a spirit greater than ourselves. And that we're actually, ultimately, I believe, we don't rely on our own psyche. We rely on a goodness that is greater than evil, and a love that is stronger than death.
Yeah, I mean that was my experience. When I was in my deepest, darkest days of grief, it was every day there was a moment of grace. I call it a moment of grace, and it could have been a stranger on the bus who hugged me when I was crying. It could have been a beautiful flower in a park. It could have been lighting a candle in a church. There'd be something which happened each day, which was like transcendent, which was beyond this kind of immediate grief, and it kind of. And it's being able to kind of find those moments, I think, and that's what moments of kindness, moments of love, moments of beauty, and they are transcendent. They do take us into a different place and hold you through these troubled times, I think.
I agree, absolutely, absolutely. And you often don't recognize them unless you hold on to them or look for them. I remember. I remember that time. There was going out to the supermarket. Everyone was clapping the NHS and do it. They were doing fantastic work. But I always used to go up to Tesco supermarket. And there was this same bloke there every day, and he used to, be there. And it wasn't, with the time we didn't know what was going to happen. I realized it was dangerous work, and those supermarket workers got no recognition for what they were doing. And they were often sort of insulted by the people because they didn't have the products that they wanted. But every day during COVID, he was there serving people, and he couldn't have been nicer. And he sort of give me a bag of shopping and say, "Oh, this is for the, I've saved these. This is a, I bought these. This is for your homeless group," and all this kind of thing. Just acts of goodness, acts of grace is amazing. And in that time too, I started the bishops, for in all their wisdom, well, we didn't really feel it at the time, but they closed all the churches, and they said that it was dangerous to go into church because people might get the pandemic. So there was a period where we weren't even allowed to pray in the church. So I started. I had one of these steady cams for my camera, for my iPhone. And so I thought, if I can't pray in the church, I'll go out for my hour's walk and I'll pray around London. And as slowly as things opened up, I began these sort of walks every Saturday morning with a steady cam and my camera, just not photographing me at all. In fact, I'm never in the photo, but it's just photographing the wonder of the world in which we live, really, and realizing that every part of this city was just so amazingly interesting, and that the things that people planted 200 or 300 years ago, we're still enjoying them. I remember a kind of moment of inspiration where I went to this park, and I just suddenly realized that this was designed by a man called Kent about 300 years ago, and everything that he designed in the park, he wouldn't have seen it grow. He wouldn't have seen what it looked like. And yet here we well were kind of enjoying what he'd left, or what he'd left for the world, is it? And I just thought, I mean, what, under what we're leaving behind for the world. I mean, what will future generations look back on the 21st century and say, what did they leave for us that has become a blessing for us?
We're coming to an end of the podcast, Richard. It's been really lovely talking with you. I ask guests what it means to live a good life and to create a good society. You've spoken quite a lot already about that, but any final thoughts you want to share with the audience?
There is a in my international group, there is a young person who's been homeless for 10 years, and he's from Yemen, and he came in, and he always looked fairly depressed every week. He came in and ate his food and looked depressed, and one week he got really upset and started shouting at someone who'd pushed in a queue, and it was just getting dark, and I said, "How are you feeling?" And he said, "I'm feeling terrible." I said, "Why?" He said, "Well," he said, "my mother always said to me when I was a young kid in Yemen, she always said to me, 'You must get home before it gets dark.'" And he said, For the last 10 years, I've been trying to find my way home before it gets dark. And he said, I've never yet found my way home. And I suppose what I would say is that we've got to help each other find our way home. And it can be something really quite simple. With that man from Yemen, I said to him, would you like, rather than to be a guest here, would you like to help me become a volunteer? And he looked up, and I thought he'd think I was absolutely crazy. And he said, what, you want me to be a volunteer here? And I said, yeah. He said, yeah, I'd love that. And just in the last 2 months, to see the difference between someone who got into the situation where he thought all his life he would never be able to give. He's just transformed by his ability to give and look after people rather than be looked after. And so this is a roundabout, a long answer to your question. I just think that we become who we are by giving, by sharing what is alive in us, by being generous, by opening up to others, by not being condemnatory and full of judgment, by actually seeing the giftedness and the grace in the world in which we live, and in the fact that diversity is exciting. It's not threatening, it's exciting, and that we can learn so much from one another. And once we begin to share these simple truths, you know, once we begin to share what's alive in us, then we begin to receive from others what's alive in them.
Beautiful, Richard. Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts. And I'm wishing you a peaceful Christmas. I know it's going to be very busy, but some peace within it, I hope you find. And you take care of yourself.
Well, Simon, it's always a pleasure. And I mean this, to see you. I mean, we always find it very easy to talk. And I've probably talked too much on this podcast, but when I'm with you, I always feel very opened up, and you're a wonderful man to share with, and you're always welcome here whenever you come. And
you. Yeah, we'll see you next year. You take care.
God bless.
Bye-bye. And finally, to thank Richard once again for the beautiful wisdom he shared with us and for the service he offers to others. I highly recommend his latest book, Letters from Nazareth, A Contemplative Journey Home. It's a beautiful read, and you can find it on any platform, and the links are on our show notes. This is the final podcast of the year, so wishing you all peace and love during this festive season, and I look forward to being with you next year. Go well.